I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and this is Charlotte Talks. In Charlotte this week, it's a bunker mentality, and fairways and greens, too. Today marks the start of the 99th PGA Championship, one of golf's four major events. Quail Hollow Club is hosting the PGA, and it's the first time one of golf's four major championships has ever been played in Charlotte. Practice rounds run today through Wednesday, and the four-day tournament begins on Thursday. Later in the show, we're going to turn to the stock market and the lack of wage growth. But first, the PGA Championship. Joining me today are Jason Mingle, who is the championship director of the tournament, writer Ron Green Jr. of Global Golf Post, and Jaime Diaz of Golf Digest. We're going to start with Jason Mingle, who joins us by phone. Jason, good morning. It's Monday. It's time to play golf at Quail Hollow. How are things looking out there?
Good morning. I'm happy to report that we opened the gates on time this morning at 7 a.m., and I'm looking out my window right now, and it's not currently raining, so we're off and running.
Very good. So your job at the PGA of America typically takes you to a host site for 1 to 2 years leading up to a PGA championship. You came here, I believe, in October of 2015. What stands out about your time in Charlotte leading into this week?
Yeah, a couple things. So we did open our office here in October of 2015, and you know, one thing that I really wanted to note is you know, it's not surprising probably to the listeners out there to know that, you know, this community is so prideful in everything we do. And you know, I remember the first roundtable meeting we had with whether it was CMPD or CDOT or some other local officials, and it was like they were putting the band back together, I felt like. And so, you know, from that point forward, we've had such a great level of cooperation every turn. You know, we've had such wonderful support from golf fans throughout the region and corporations here and volunteers that, you know, we just can't say thank you enough and so excited that it's finally here.
That's the voice of Jason Mingle. He's the tournament director of the PGA Championship. Ron Green Jr. from Global Golf Post is in studio with me, and Jaime Diaz from Golf Digest is on the phone as well. Before I let Ron and Jaime ask the questions that are actually really important, I do want you to, Jason, maybe take us through your week. What will you do this week? How will your days run here during the PGA Championship?
Well, we just started at the beginning of the day. Alarm went off at 3 o'clock this morning. I was on site here at Quail Hollow by 4 a.m. You know, it's a Monday morning of Champ Week, so it's not only a practice round for the players, it's a practice round for all the staff and volunteers that are on site, maybe in some cases for the first time. And so we got through. We're well prepared, I think, for a successful remainder of the week, but I'll be here on site today. I've got various meetings, and we're hosting some people over the course of the next 3 days. And then Thursday, once things get a little more serious here, once the competition actually starts, you know, we'll be, of course, joining everyone and watching the wonderful storylines that unfold. But I'm here, you know, 3 a.m. to 10:30 p.m. every day, and this is really a week where our staff runs on a lot of adrenaline, as you can imagine.
And your staff, about how many people?
Our full-time staff here that's been in the office at Quail Hollow, we're up to 9. We've got dozens of interns, we'll say, that are working for us this week, and some that's been with us for a couple summers. But it's so unique because we have also the support of the PGA Championship Host Committee, which we have about 75 chairmen on, including our general chair, Ralph Breeden, and our vice chairs, Andrea Smith and Tom Nelson. And, of course, Johnny Harris is one of those members of the leadership team as well. And then we bring up about 100 staff from Palm Beach Gardens to come up here and focus on their specific area, whether it's media relations or partner development, you name it. We've got kind of a village that comes together to pull this thing off.
So Ron Green Jr. and Jaime Diaz, who are joining us, I'd like to hear from each of you on what you think are, you know, what you're looking for here at Quail Hollow. You've been to a number of PGA championships and majors. So what are your expectations, and what do you think the rest of the country is going to learn about Quail Hollow this week as this tournament unfolds? I'm going to let Ron start since he's looking right at me. He's here in the studio. And then, Jaime, if you could follow Ron.
Well, I think just the scale of it. If you've been to the Wells Fargo Championship, you have a sense of what Quail Hollow and Charlotte golf is. But this is twofold, threefold. Shoot, with the flooring and stuff they've put out there, fivefold. I mean, it's an enormous thing. I mean, just driving up here today, I see buses. I can see, like, where the media parking buses are, shuttle buses are, and others. I mean, you're going to see more and more of that. Just the walkthrough, when you come into the golf course and come out at the 18th hole, and that very big Belk-style-sized merchandise facility they have right there. I just think it's – I mean, there's a reason there's only four of these each year. And you get the feel of what it is. And I think the longer the week goes on, the bigger it will get. It's just – I mean, these are the ones that sort of – they define cities and clubs in a way. But more than that, they define the best players. And that's why we all tune in and pay attention to them.
Jaime, what about you? What are you expecting here in Charlotte this week?
Well, you know, the Wells Fargo or the, you know, Wachovia, whatever it's been, it's always been a big-time event. And I think that emanates from the leader, Johnny Harris, who I think has huge ambitions and for the good, you know, for the good of the community and good of golf. And I kind of look at what he's done at Quail Hollow sort of on the Augusta model. I mean, on a slightly smaller scale, but, you know, with a bullet, so to speak. I mean, the trajectory is going up, and this is a big step for Quail Hollow to become a big-time golf site. It's already that, but it's, you know, a major always elevates it. And I just feel like he's going to spare no expense, spare no, you know, scrutiny of attention or detail, and it's going to be, you know, Quail Hollow is going to shine and Charlotte's going to shine. You can't control who wins the event, but if one of the big names wins it, and it happens to be Jordan Spieth especially, that'll really make some history and really make Charlotte a place that was at a pivotal point in golf history.
For all of you, but let's start with Jason Mingle, the championship director. You know, the past year, a lot of discussion went on, not just with the PGA Championship, but with the NBA All-Star Game and other events. House Bill 2 was such a controversial bill. It cost the state and Charlotte a lot of events. It was repealed in March. And Jason, if you don't mind starting, I'm wondering how much that made life easier for you, not having that as a distraction coming into tournament week?
Yeah, I think from our standpoint, we just remain focused on the same things we've always remained focused on, which is creating an inclusive and welcoming environment for everybody on site. You know, there's a number of things we're doing both in the run-up to the event and then again during championship week that exemplifies that. You know, today we've got Young Black Men and Young Black Women Leadership Alliance out here doing a day-long leadership forum. You know, tomorrow we have a Four Chambers event with the Gay and Lesbian Chamber and the Asian Chamber and a couple others from here in Charlotte. You know, we had a diversity supplier symposium earlier this year. And so really our focus remains on simply creating an inclusive and welcoming environment for everyone.
Now, Ron Jr. And Jaime, both of you are not old, but you're old enough to remember Shoal Creek.
I'm old.
I'm older than about everybody now.
But you're old enough to remember Shoal Creek, as am I, in, I think, what was that, 1990? I'm trying to remember, late 80s,
right,
early 90s,
here.
In Birmingham, and that was a matter of diversity in the membership of that club. That's a long way of me asking you, how do you think HB2 might have sort of infringed or caused controversy, difficulty for this PGA Championship if it was still intact?
Well, I mean, you just look at what it did, how it disrupted the life of the state and changed. You know, everything became contentious, and there was, you know, all the fallout from it. I mean, it was such a relief to get it pulled off the books and changed so that they can go forward with this. I'm sure it would have been, there would have been a cloud. It would have been, I don't know if you want to call it a sidebar, but that would have been another story thread through this week had things stayed the way they were. But fortunately, they got past that, so we can, you know, concentrate on the golf tournament and all that it encompasses, because it does, I don't know, consume the community, but it really becomes a huge part. I mean, I was out yesterday, not anywhere near the golf course, and people were talking about, oh, that golf tournament's starting Monday. And I mean, it's a big deal. And it's, fortunately, now it doesn't have to deal with that shadow over it.
Jaime?
Well, Shoal Creek is a very, I think, pivotal moment in the history of golf. Golf did not have a great history for inclusiveness, and there was a lot of racism, there was a lot of classism, there was a lot of exclusion. And that was a moment where everybody decided we cannot continue this way. And anything that replicates that or comes close to it is toxic. And while, you know, I'm very glad the state correct, you know, it's just my opinion, but I don't think it's in any way. And just from the few mentioned, it sounds like PGA of America is compensating to make sure There's no suggestion of any, of any of golf's old history. Quite the contrary. So, in a way, I think HB2 is probably productive in terms of what it's done for golf in a small way, even though golf was already on its way, I think, away from its old history because of Shoal Creek. But it was a reminder, we can't go that way anymore.
Jason Mingle, since you're here with us just through the first segment, I want you to speak a little bit about, some of the things fans need to keep in mind as they're heading out either today or later in the week, just in terms of some of the logistics, because as Ron Green Jr. mentioned, this is not your everyday Wells Fargo Championship. Sorry.
Yeah, a couple things worth noting. We aren't selling tickets at the gate today or tomorrow, so you got to have a championship ticket when you arrive. You're of course welcome to go to primesport.com, which is our official ticket exchange, to see what inventory remains available on their site. If you're looking to drive yourself, time of year of the event, and also the needs of our logistical footprint here at Quail Hollow have necessitated a different plan than years past. So got to make sure that if you are looking to drive yourself, you purchase that parking pass in advance, and you can go to pjachampionship.com to do that. But it's not the only way you can get to the event. You can Uber to our dedicated pickup drop-off lot and ride the shuttle right to the front door. You can take the light rail system here in Charlotte, and if you have a ticket for that day, you can ride the light rail for free, and we'll shuttle you right from Sharon Road West to the front gate. Important to note, and certainly this morning, you're going to spend the day outside. So wear comfortable shoes, wear sunscreen. You can buy an umbrella and a hat here, so we've got that covered for you in our championship shops. But prepare to spend the day outside.
Now, Jason, obviously you've been working at the PGA of America for many years. You've been to plenty of PGA championships and Ryder Cups and other events. So that's a long way of me asking you, do you ever get to actually watch any golf during these weeks?
There'll be two points in time where I kind of gather our staff to make sure we take a deep breath and enjoy what's going on, and that's Thursday morning when the first tee shot is struck off number one. And then it's on the 18th hole as the last few groups are coming in. That's kind of a special time for everybody who's put so much time and effort into what's going on here this week.
And as I mentioned, you've been here almost 2 years. At what point will, once the tournament is done, how long does it take you to kind of clean up and get out of town so you can move on to your next assignment?
Yeah, we'll have the office open here until probably October 1st, October 15th. You know, it's our commitment to the club and the community to put everything back here, at least get it started in heading in the direction of the way we found it here at Quail Hollow. We want to make sure that we have a great relationship with the community and with our stakeholders in the event. And so we'll do follow-up meetings and surveys, and it's going to take time to analyze that even after we close the office here. I'll be headed up north personally back to Wisconsin for the 2020 Ryder Cup so we can open an office back in Kohler.
Well, I want to thank Jason Mingle, the championship director at the PGA Championship. He's got a lot to do the rest of the day, so Jason, we will free you to do that. In the meantime, Ron Green Jr. from Global Golf Post and Jaime Diaz of Golf Digest are going to stay with us, and in the next segment, we're going to get into some of the nitty-gritty of actually what's going to go on the course at the PGA Championship at Quail Hollow Club this week. Stay with us here on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members in the British International School of Charlotte, now offering the International Baccalaureate Diploma Program, dedicated to providing a gateway to university and a roadmap to academic and personal excellence. More at bischarlotte.org. And Duke Energy, committed to building a smarter energy future for the Carolinas. More at duke-energy.com/future. When we turn on the tap, we feel assured that the water is safe to drink. Making it so takes a lot of work. And Charlotte Water, our public water utility, reports our water meets federal standards for safety. But there are threats, and we talk about those in the first hour of the program tomorrow. Then Charlotte and mosquitoes. We're on the list of the top 50 mosquito-plagued cities, and we hear about research being done to predict where mosquito-borne diseases will occur. That's when Charlotte Talks tomorrow at 9 here on 90.7 WFAE.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, affirmative action and the Trump administration, talk of discrimination against Asian Americans, white Americans. We'll dig in. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
On Point, coming up at 10, right after Charlotte Talks. Here on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE. Charlotte's NPR news source.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are talking about the PGA Championship this morning. I'm joined by Ron Green Jr. from Global Golf Post, which I can't say apparently, and Jaime Diaz from Golf Digest. Both of them have covered the PGA Tour for many, many years, and of course, everyone has their eye on Charlotte this week. Ron, I want to start with you. You recently wrote a column talking about your long experience with golf in the Carolinas, and you were recalling being a young boy following Arnold Palmer around at the Kemper Open. I think it was the first one in 1969. And obviously, that was at Quail Hollow, and we had this period where there was a PGA tournament for a decade, then it went away, and then things kind of bounced around, and then in 2003, the Wachovia Championship arrives, what is now the Wells Fargo Championship. So that's a long way of me leading in to ask you, how do you think this moment compares to some of the other benchmarks we've had in the Carolinas? We've had, obviously, Ryder Cup and the PGA Championship at Kiawa. The U.S. Open, since 1999, has become part of the regular rotation of Pinehurst. How do you think this one fits in with those?
Well, I think in sort of the galaxy of things that have happened at Quail Hollow, this is the high point. I don't think it's the last high point. I think there'll be more of those. But I think this is, there's been sort of an evolution. You know, when Johnny Harris's dad, Mr. Harris, created Quail Hollow, Arnold Palmer was involved, and there was the discussion about, if you build this club, I will help you get a tournament. And sure enough, they did. And then when the Kemper Open went away, they brought, I think it was the second senior tour event ever. Mm-hmm. They had the Legends, and they brought that here, and we saw what that grew into. And so I just think this is a huge moment for Charlotte and for golf, because, and as you said, I think earlier, if Jordan Spieth chasing the career Grand Slam happens to win, I mean, that the way he won the Open Championship, I think that fueled a momentum that's still sort of rolling as they come into Charlotte here. You've got, I mean, Rory McIlroy with his great record here. I mean, he was talking the other day up at Firestone. You know, he's so familiar with Charlotte. He was even here for a wedding last August, snuck out and saw the new holes. But I just think this is, I hope it's not the end, obviously, but it's the highest point right now, and I think there are a lot more things, optimistic things down the line here.
Jaime Diaz, you heard Ron Green Jr. He just mentioned a couple of the key players this week. I think they're both 8-1 odds to win, the best odds out of Las Vegas, and I don't know much about Vegas, but I read that at ESPN.com. So Rory McIlroy and Jordan Spieth, for our listeners who are not steeped maybe in golf, could you explain a little bit about what makes these two players unique and why they might be interesting to watch this week?
Well, sort of in the post-Tiger era, they are the two most promising future all-time greats, I guess you could say, and Rory has the most, although Jordan right now, of course, is the man of the moment. Rory actually has the most bona fides, so to speak. He's won four majors championships. He's 28 years old, and so he's way ahead of the curve as far as, you know, piling up some majors, although sometimes that faucet stops. You never know when. But Rory's distinguished himself, in, especially because he won two of those by 8 strokes, which kind of is a throwback to that Tiger dominance when he was winning Masters by 12 and U.S. Opens by 15. And you just don't see that much anymore. And so Rory has that, or is perceived to have that extra gear that allows him to really separate when he's on. The question is, how often is he on? And he hasn't been on very much because he hasn't won a major since 2014. Even though he was off to that hot start. Now, Jordan is, in a way, even more of a prodigy and a phenomenon because he, you know, he won the U.S. Junior. He won a lot of tournaments at age 21 as a tour player, and now he's won three legs of the Grand Slam. He was number one in the world, succeeding Rory McIlroy, among others, and then was looking like he was going on a Tiger trajectory, and he had that unfortunate finish at the Masters in 16, and that sort of derailed him, I think, at least temporarily. And that's why last month at the Open Championship was so important because it looked like he was having a similar kind of struggle on the back nine when he was leading the tournament wire to wire and actually fell into a tie for the lead. And at that moment, with five holes to go, or I guess six holes to go, he just went on this incredible tear and you know, took back the tournament and just captured it in this really dramatic way. And so he's riding that role right now. And not only has he got the three legs of the Grand Slam so he can complete it, the career Grand Slam has only been won by five players, Gene Sarazen, Ben Hogan, Gary Player, Jack Nicklaus, and Tiger Woods. So that would be a really elite pantheon, so to speak, for Jordan Spieth to achieve. And if he did it, he'd be the youngest man ever to do it.
By the way, those five guys are pretty good. If you're not following golf closely, those are five of the best who have ever played the game. And as we're mentioning career Grand Slam and the majors, what we're talking about are the Masters, obviously, in Augusta, Georgia, the U.S. Open, which moves year to year to different courses, the Open, which many of us knew as the British Open until we were told it was the Open, and then the PGA Championship, which is here this week. So that's why this is such a big deal in the golf world, because you really essentially only have two of those four tournaments that move around the United States. And so obviously courses don't – there are a lot of courses that want those two events, and they're hard to come by. So that leads me into you know, the idea of being part of an informal rotation, which you see with the U.S. Open and the PGA Championship. We've already had a couple people from the PGA of America, the sanctioning body that runs the PGA Championship, hint pretty strongly that they would consider Quail Hollow in the future. I'd like to hear from both of you what you think needs to happen this week for that to become reality. I'll start with you, Ron Green Jr.
Well, I think they're off to a great start because of the ticket sales and the hospitality sales. I mean, it's a golf tournament, but it's also there's a business equation to it. And to be that successful, that gives you all the gold stars starting out. So I think that puts them ahead of the curve. I think there's an interest there. There are a lot of moving parts as they get ready to change the schedule on the PGA Tour. I expect this week they're going to announce the PGA Championship is going to move to May instead of August. It'll become the second leg. Now, that of the four majors, and that would play right into Quail Hollow. In one sense, they're used to having an event in May, but it requires changing the grass and doing a lot of things that disrupts the golf course. So, you know, I think it's a kind of thing where I would expect more big events here. I mean, they've made no secret they'd love to get the 2028 Ryder Cup here. That's sort of, you can't get the Masters out of Augusta, but if you can get the Ryder Cup, you've sort of hit the home run. And I think though another one of these, I mean, Johnny Harris loves the big event, and Charlotte loves big events. I mean, from Final Fours, from NFC Championships, all the other things, this city responds to that.
Jaime Diaz, what do you think?
Well, I think Ron phrased it very well. You know, Quail Hollow, Charlotte is very well positioned to have a great week. You know, weather is an issue in August, especially in the South. There's just a lot of rain. And that can put a damper on things, obviously. But, you know, I think, you know, the grounds crew, everybody's used to that. We're used to the PGA getting hit with rain in August in most places. So that's not going to be, I think, a deal breaker in any way. I do think, though, if there is a move back to Maine, it's looking that way, that really helps Quail Hollow, because it eliminates some of the northeast stalwart golf courses that have been major championship hosts. From the PGA, it's just too cold up there at that time of year, or the grasses aren't grown in and the courses just aren't ready, and it helps the courses in the Sun Belt and in the Southern Hemisphere. So Quail Hollow, I think, actually, which I expect to have first of all, Ron made the biggest point, is they have the organization and they have the will of the leader to make this a big-time event, and that's just the most important thing, because no expense will be spared, no detail will be ignored. And that just makes such a difference in the way that the championship's presented. So I think Quail Hollow will come across very well, as it always does in April, in early May in the Wells Fargo. So, you know, I just feel like it's going to be a good championship at the very least. It could be a historic one. And going forward, Quail Hollow is going to gain points in terms of becoming more of a prominent spot in golf.
Let's talk about the piece of property that matters the most this week, which is the actual course where the players will be.
Talk about media parking.
Well, yeah, that's right. Media parking's one, then the course. There have been a number of changes at this course, not only since 2003 when the PGA Tour came back, but particularly during the past year. I'd like to hear from both of you. I'm going to let you start, Ron Jr., with some of the things that went on in the past year. Four holes basically remade, but there were other changes as well.
Yeah, I mean, they created, I think, I forget how many companies they had come in and overnight took out hundreds, I think 900 trees off the golf course, rebuilt the first hole, built a new fourth and fifth hole, changed the 11th hole a little bit, all part of a master plan. I mean, when they got the PGA Championship, that was the course they're playing this week was not the course they sold them on. They made the changes. They convinced Kerry Hagan, the people at the PGA of America, this could work. They could do it. They had some issues with the grass on the greens. They had some mutation in the grass they had put on there, so they needed to change that. So it just it prompted this giant project over last summer, I think 88 days or something like that. So it's a different golf course. I've heard several players talk about it. I don't know how many of them love it compared to what it was, because they loved when they first got to Quail Hollow. They loved what it was, old classic style golf course. And the essence
what
of that.
What do they
is,
mean by that? By the way, for people who are not steeped in golf,
you know, just I mean, you can't fake the old trees and all that. It just looked like some of those northeastern courses to some degree had some. You know, similarities to Augusta in places. And I think what they've done now is they've just made it more difficult. Talking to the players who've been out here, it's just a harder, more modern-feeling golf course. I think for the people who are familiar with Wells Fargo, they may not notice the trees being gone as much because there's such infrastructure out there. There are so many chalets and things that's what you see a lot of. But it's, you know, I mean, it's in the same way Augusta makes changes, I think – this golf course is sort of a living, breathing, changeable thing, and they do it because they think they can make the golf course better.
Jaime Diaz, obviously Tom Fazio, the acclaimed golf architect, has been the mastermind behind this. What are you hearing in terms of the new look Quail Hollow?
Well, it's probably a good sign that the players don't really like it, because it means they've been pushing the envelope and they're taking them out of their comfort zone, and they're really trying to identify the best player who's going to have to show the most skill. And that's always something players generally tend to push back against when it's first in front of them, because, you know, they don't like, obviously, having to hit shots that they're uncomfortable with. But that's really what determines the best player. And I think Quail Hollow has done that really well in the past, especially because they have one of the best finishes in golf. And you hear that cliche a lot, you know, the greatest finishing hole in golf. But I think the Green Mile, the last four holes there, arguably the toughest finish on the PGA Tour. And that hasn't, as I understand it, been changed much. And so that is very good for staging a major, because it creates a lot of tension at the end and a lot of lead changes, a lot of volatility. And so that I think that's actually the strongest part about Quail Hollow as a major championship site, because it does have that sort of comfortable landscape that's you know, very classic, as Ron was describing. But it also has now a distinguishing feature, much like, you know, the TPC Stadium course has the 17th hole. Some people call that gimmicky, but it identifies the golf course in people's minds, and it strikes fear in the players. And I think the Green Mile does that for Quail Hollow.
I'm wondering, we've only said the T word once or twice, and it used to be when not only in Charlotte, but any tournament, when you got around to it and there was a question about whether Tiger Woods would play or not, it would sort of set the tone. If Tiger was out or injured or just not playing, then there was just a collective, oh. And, you know, it's just really not much of a storyline. You know, he had the DUI earlier this year. He hasn't played in many, many months. So how much impact, if any, do you expect from Tiger Woods not being in this PGA Championship?
I think it's just – I mean, we've just gotten used to life without him. I mean, it was funny being at Firestone last week. We were talking. It was 4 years ago there that he won his last golf tournament and his fifth tournament of the year. And who would have thought when you walked out of that media center that night that that was the last time, at least for the foreseeable future, that he was going to win a golf tournament? And would it be better if he were here? Absolutely. I mean, he changes everything. But the game has moved on, and I think when Jordan Spieth won the Open Championship, I think I have this right, the television ratings on Sunday were up almost 150%. There are certain people who capture the public's fascination, and Jordan is one of those. Now, you can't guarantee he's going to be in contention all the time, but if he's in contention here chasing that career slam on the weekend, CBS is going to love the numbers they get.
Jaime, what do you think about Tiger's impact?
Well, Tiger is kind of he's omnipresent in one form or another. His story, his, you know, psychohistory, so to speak, of, you know, is on everybody's mind. You know, not only what he's going to do in the future, but there's a lot of reflection on the past and how great he was and then how he had this incredible reversal of fortune that probably is historic in golf in sports terms as far as a fall from grace and how he's going to recover from that. I think it's in everybody's mind. And does he have to play right now? I don't think anybody wants to see him until he feels he's ready. And so I think golf kind of has that in its pocket a little bit. I mean, you could say it's a negative. Where's Tiger and it ruins the game? I think not the opposite, but I think there's a positive aspect to it, that there's this future kind of you know, extra value thing in the future when Tiger does come back, because right now, you know, golf is fine. Tiger is has been a driver for it and will be again if he comes back, but it's not like golf's fallen in the dregs. I mean, golf as a participatory sport is having a lot of challenges. As a spectator sport, as a television audience sport, and especially right now with a major being played, with a Grand Slam at stake, golf's in a very good position. So I think Tiger's out there in people's heads, and I think the majority of people really wish him well and hope he does come back, and it would be great for golf and all those things. I don't think there's an urgency that it has to happen right away. It has to happen in his time, and if it happens in a good way, that's going to be an extra bonus.
Yeah, even among casual fans, I just don't hear the same. As he says, you know, people would love to have him back, but it doesn't seem like all is lost. You know, that used to be kind
there's
of mentality.
There's a lot of sympathy, you know, I think there's mostly compassion for Tiger Woods. I know there's people who don't like him, and he's been polarizing, but I think, you know, he's paid. If he comes back now, he's truly paid his dues, and it will be, I think, a wonderful story of redemption if he makes it back.
Ron, we have just a little bit of time left, and before we go, I did want to have you address the issue of not only Johnny Harris bringing the PGA, he's the president of Quail Hollow Club, but he's 70 years old. He's been the president for 30 years, and similar to maybe the story with Jerry Richardson owning the Carolina Panthers, what happens with this club and with major golf events when Johnny Harris is no longer the president out there?
Gosh, I haven't given that a whole lot of thought, but he is a force of nature. And if you're around him, you get it and you hear it, and it's just, you kind of get swept up in it. But yeah, I think his son, Jono, understands what his father has wanted for the club. I mean, it's the members club, but it's a family club too, given the way it got started and Johnny's presence there and influence. I think Jono will be largely responsible, have a big role in sort of maintaining the vision. You know, I mean, Johnny operates in special circles with clubs and everything, but I think the club will roll on. But, I mean, I can just see Johnny rolling on for a long time.
He'll outlast all of us. That's the voice of Ron Green Jr. from Global Golf Post. Jaime Diaz from Golf Digest, thanks to both of you and to Jason Mingle, the championship director. When we come back, we're going to switch gears and we're going to talk about Wall Street and wage growth here on Charlotte Talks.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Labor Day, September 3rd, features trail races, deep water solo climbing competition, fireworks, and live music from Leftover Salmon. USNWC.org. And Charlotte Douglas International Airport, reminding summer travelers to arrive at CLT Airport early and follow all airline and TSA packing guidelines. More info at CLTAirport.com. Coming up next at 10 o'clock on On Point, guest host Jane Clayson is in for Tom Ashbrook today with a program about rethinking affirmative action. Affirmative action and the Trump administration, where there's talk of discrimination against Asian Americans and white Americans. That conversation coming up on Point next after Charlotte Talks at 10 here on Listener Funded 90.7 WFAE.
When you're catching up on the day's news, the headlines are a good place to start. But to really understand the world and what's happening, you want the full story. All Things Considered takes the time to explore the details and differences to find meaning in the day's biggest stories. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
News throughout the day, on air at 90.7 WFAE and online at WFAE.org.
Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. And joining me now, we have Tim Quinlan from Wells Fargo and Matthew Martin from the Federal Reserve of Richmond. And we're going to talk money, as in the economy, which keeps making significant gains on the stock market in particular. The number of jobs has now increased for 82 consecutive months. But at the same time, wages aren't keeping pace, which is not only frustrating workers, but creating concerns for economists. So with these trends in motion now, and we had the Dow eclipse 22,000 last week, which was a new record, what do you make of this sort of Jekyll and Hyde economy we have going here? I'm going to start with you, Tim Quinlan.
I guess I'd say broadly, it's certainly pretty late in the cycle, whether you're talking about the economy or the stock market. You know, believe it or not, once we turned the corner into the current month, we're now in the ninth year of this economic expansion. And in terms of this bull market in equities, we're in the 100th month of the current bull market. Now, the longest on record, many listeners probably know, is the 1990s. That one was 113. So these things don't die of old age, but it's late in the cycle, and we've yet to see the translation between steady economic growth and strong stock market gains lead through to, you know, significant income growth or wage gains.
What do you see happening there, Matthew?
Yeah, I think Tim's right on all that. I'd add, though, remember the hole we came out of when this recovery expansion started, right? We call it the Great Recession for a reason. It's not same category as a Great Depression, but it was the worst recession we'd seen for a while, unemployment above 10%. So we had a lot of ground to make up. And I think when you combine that with sort of this steady, almost dull in some ways, 2% growth we've seen year in and year out or thereabouts, it, in some sense, it's not surprising. It's taken us this long to get to a place where unemployment is now getting to that 4% level, and it's looking like, as Tim described it, we're sort of late in the cycle.
Yeah, you mentioned 2% growth, and Tim Quinlan here from Wells Fargo had just written a report recently about President Trump and the administration budgeting for 3% growth, and the president had even said 4 or 5% growth he thought was in reach. And you outlined some of the reasons why you think that would be a reach. And one of the things you mentioned is that 2% growth has kind of been the norm since 2000. So you mentioned productivity and demographics among the forces working against those projections by President Trump. If you can explain a little bit, why are those forces in particular so difficult to overcome?
Sure. I mean, I guess the way of thinking about it, you know, if you're thinking about this as a listener, is, you know, in order to get the kind of job growth to get us to 3% in terms of overall participation in the labor force, you would need the kind of increases that we saw in the 1970s. That was when baby boomers kind of reached working age, and at the same time you had women joining the workforce in much larger numbers. Now, alternatively, you could say, all right, well, you know, I think we can all agree that the demographics aren't there to support that, but, you know, what if we were to see some kind of really strong capital investment to boost productivity numbers? And we find there that you would need to not only match the late 1990s, the last period where we had really strong capital spending growth, you'd actually need to have capital spending growth even faster than we saw in that period. So neither of those factors are necessarily obtainable or reachable, which puts 3% growth kind of slightly out of reach in our view on a sustained basis. Now, you might have a one-off quarter here or there where you have an inventory build or something that contributes to a 4% growth rate. But on a sustained basis, 3% is not real doable in our estimation.
Now, for people who are out there maybe wondering, well, why does it matter if we hit 3% or 2%, what is the everyday impact of that?
Well, you need a steady rate of GDP growth in order to sustain long-term projections for things like, you know, Social Security funding and just long-term government revenues. And the Congressional Budget Office, kind of a nonpartisan group that looks at these things, has a much less rosy assessment of things and puts in what we'd consider to be a more workable 2 to 2.5% growth for their long-term projections.
That's the voice of Tim Quinlan from Wells Fargo and Matthew Martin. I wanted to ask you, many of us in the media, and I'm guilty as well, and others tend to look at the stock market and just sort of say, that's the economy. So when the stock market hits 22,000, sets a new record, a lot of people say, well, you know, the economy must be pretty strong. I know that's obviously not the totality of the economy, but how effective is that as a barometer of what's going on nationally with the economy?
Sure. So stock market indices are a fairly good barometer. They're not the only one. But if you think about it, people are putting money where their mouth is, and they're making assessments on individual companies. Or if you're just a broader investor and you invest in an index fund on the companies more broadly. So you're making an assessment of what you think the current health is and where you think the economy is going more broadly, or specifically those companies. I'd caution the Dow is 30 big companies, but it's still just 30. You'd want to look at some others for that indication as well. And I think when you take that and look at other data, it suggests we've got a broadly healthy economy. So I think that's right. And it's, you know, economists often talk about the wisdom of markets. It's really hard to beat the stock market on average. So generally, the stock market's pretty good indicator.
Now, as we all know, Bill Clinton's campaign strategist James Carville famously said in 1992, it's the economy, stupid. And I think when we get into the economy, for most of us, it's the paycheck, stupid. So when we look at this economic growth and some of these trends, why is it not translating into stronger wage growth? I think it was a 2.5% increase in the most recent report compared to the same period in 2016, which is not very strong. Why is that?
Boy, I wish I knew, because that's one thing that we've kind of struggled with in terms of our forecast recently. And 2.5%, by the way, is numbers that we're supposed to be excited about. That's about as fast a pace as job growth as we've seen, or excuse me, wage growth as we've seen in this cycle. If you compare it to the 90s, though, going back to James Carville at the beginning of the Clinton administration, we never had a pace of wage growth in the 90s that was slower than 3.5%. So this is a really significant downshift here. Now, some of Matt's colleagues at the Atlanta Fed have a wage growth tracker index, and that does a pretty good job of capturing the inflection points or the turning points. And over the last few months, we've seen a bit of a gapping between that Atlanta Fed's wage growth tracker and the average hourly earnings. So, gosh, fingers crossed here. We're looking for that wage growth to really start to pick up. But so far, it hasn't done so in a way that is really pushing inflation higher, which we kind of need it to do.
And he mentioned the Fed. Obviously, you're with the Fed, Federal Reserve of Richmond, not the Atlanta branch. But Matthew Martin, I'm wondering some of the things that are some of the, I guess, some of the explanations for this lack of wage growth include a lot of people in that 25 to 54-year-old category still sitting on the sidelines and basically saying it's not worth it for me yet because wages aren't high enough to offset child care and other things. I'm wondering how much credence you put in that and what you think the other factors might be that are causing this.
Yeah, I think there's probably various explanations. One of my frames of reference as a regional Federal Reserve Bank, we collect a lot of regional information, and one of our roles is to try and get a read on the real-time economy, and from our Charlotte office, we do that in the Carolinas. And I can tell you some of the reports we've heard is you got to break it down. So we've been talking about wages overall, but if you look at different markets for different types of labor in different areas, there are pockets where wage growth is much stronger. So for years, for example, we've been hearing in Asheville that they're having a hard time getting hospitality workers, and wages there have gone up quite a bit. So some of that then becomes a geographic problem. How do you generate more of a workforce in a relatively small metro area that's kind of hard to get to in some ways? In others, it's just industry. So IT is one that's classically held out as one being short on workers, and so you get faster wage growth there. So it's not been universal. And I think some of this is some industries, it is as the economy is improved. Wage growth, I would note, even as where it is, inflation's lower, so there is actually real wage growth overall. That is, purchasing power is outpacing inflation. And you are starting to see, and we saw it in the last month's jobs report, people getting pulled into the labor force and starting to look for work again. So I think that's part of it. So the underlying question then is, how far away are we from true full employment still?
Yeah, and the unemployment rate's 4.3%, I think. It ticked down just a little bit. One of the things that's been talked about a lot in the past couple of years, obviously, is with Uber and all these other companies, the so-called gig economy. How much of an impact do you think that's having in what's going on with wage growth or lack of wage growth right now?
I don't know that it's a major driver of it, but I think it's a factor that economists kind of struggle with how to measure because there's not a reliable time series that we can look at and see how it's behaved in prior cycles. Indeed, a lot of these industries weren't around in prior cycles. I think maybe an optimist's way of looking at it is it helps round off some of the harder edges of transition and job insecurity to be able to at least augment a small paycheck or, have another source of income during tricky times.
I mentioned several times the stock market and the strong growth there. One of the things that I was wondering about is typically Wall Street has gotten jittery during times of political uncertainty, political controversy. However you feel about the Trump administration, there's certainly been plenty of uncertainty and plenty of controversy. So I'll start with you, Matthew Martin. Why is the Dow, defying the odds or defying the trends of the past this time around, do you think?
So I think in part it's just results. So if you're looking at the individual results of the 30 companies in the Dow, I think I saw some report last week that one or two companies were driving a lot of the recent gains. They're on a good run. It's a relatively small index, so they're helping lift it. So it's how those individual companies are doing. And I think you look around, companies have done a good job of managing balance sheets, responding to demand in measured ways. And I think, like consumers, they've positioned themselves to be in a very healthy spot as far as debt and there's some of those other factors that in the end would influence stock prices.
What do you see, Tim?
Yeah, I would kind of second that, and that's true for the S&P 500 as well, where the so-called FANG stocks, Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and Google, have contributed by some estimates more than a third of all of the gains in this stock market rally just from those few companies. So, that's part of it. The other thing is it's just uncharacteristically calm in financial markets. If you look at things like the VIX index, the volatility index, or a measure of fear in financial markets, it's at more than decade lows, 14, 15 year lows. And, this is to me a little bit like when in a movie people look around and say, why have all the forest creatures gone quiet? I tend to get nervous at points like that.
Well, and as a follow up, I'm wondering, obviously the White House and people who support Trump are going to say that some of this growth must be attributable to White House policy. How would you assess that so far?
Well, I think there's undeniably some measures of improvement in business confidence, particularly small businesses. The NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business, has had perhaps the most pronounced example of confidence kind of surging in the wake of the election. But other measures, I think, are a little more spotty. The ISM index, some of the regional Fed surveys, consumer confidence, particularly forward-looking measures. What we're seeing there is kind of the sugar high is coming off a little bit. There were big grand expectations, and here we are 6 or 7 months into this administration, and the scoreboard is still at zero. I think people are beginning to demand some proof that there's going to be some changes.
Matthew, Tim just mentioned being in the forest and all the creatures have gone quiet. I'm wondering what sense, if any, do you have of unease of what's out there ahead?
Yeah, I don't have any indicators or can't point to when you think of a recession looming on the future, you sort of look for imbalances in the economy. Obviously, the Great Recession, the housing finance imbalances were the one to look at there. And it's hard to see anything like that. I hear talk about multifamily. I look around Charlotte, for example, and we're building a lot of apartments, but in part because we're not building enough single-family homes, or we haven't up to this point at least. So that's hard to see. My own personal indicator is when I'm watching the business news and some Wall Street younger type gets on and says, this time it's different. Then you need to run for the hills.
So we haven't heard that, at least hopefully, lately. Since both of you, we've talked a lot about national and statewide trends, but you both obviously live in Charlotte. So if you don't mind, in the last few minutes, maybe give us a little overview of what you see going on in the local regional economy right now.
I think a lot of positive things. If we could have gone back to October, November of 2008, and you told me where Charlotte is today, boy, I think even the biggest optimists wouldn't have believed it. Things look pretty dark at the height of the financial crisis, and one of our largest employers being bought by an out-of-town bank, and a lot of concerns about it. Things are really looking up. The pace of residential construction activity is justified by a really strong positive population growth. You know, I think we're doing a little too well because traffic is getting worse. Schools are overcrowded. My kids are, you know, sitting in a trailer parts of the year for class. So I think we're seeing some good growing pains as well.
Matthew Martin, what do you see in terms of the regional economy?
Yeah, I agree with everything Tim said. When I think about then where we are now, the things that come to my mind are essentially issues around managing growth. So traffic's one, and how do you handle the infrastructure? And the other piece of this is Charlotte still has issues around economic mobility and income disparity. And until the community is more broadly engaged in solving, they're solvable, I think. They're not easy problems, but they're solvable. But until we get a little more focus around that, we're probably not going to make a whole lot of progress
there. And in terms of diversity of industries, how is Charlotte doing in that regard? Because for so long it was banks really and nothing else.
I think fairly well. And I'd be interested in Tim's perspective on this. It seems like one of our core expertise areas for this region is our ability to support headquarter companies and sort of the things that go with having companies here and professional business services in addition to some of the more traditional drivers. And we seem to keep having wins that way.
Tim, in about 10 seconds, 15 seconds, can you address it?
Sure. First of all, I see nothing wrong with banking. Banking's terrific. Secondly, you know, it's Charlotte's tradition. Trading Tryon was the intersection of two Indian trade routes. We were a rail hub. We've become an airline hub. We're an inland port to a large extent. And our access to the fastest growing parts of the country make us a good long-term bet.
That was Tim Quinlan with Wells Fargo. We had Matthew Martin from the Federal Reserve of Richmond. I'm Eric Spanberg sitting in for Mike Collins. Thanks so much for joining us for Charlotte Talks today, and Mike will be back with you tomorrow.